Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Ashman Family Jewish Community Center, a major component of the Toby Caret Center for Jewish Life in Palo Alto. My name is Tad Toby. I'm president of the Caret Foundation and chairman of Toby Philanthropies. It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce Andre Agassi, tennis legend, philanthropist, education advocate, and author of Open, an autobiography. Open, at this point, has achieved the distinction of being the number one seller on the New York Times bestsellers list with nearly 400,000 copies in print. After turning professional at the age of 16, Andre's illustrious career included several number one world rankings and 8 Grand Slam titles. He is the only male player to win the coveted career Golden Slam, which includes all 4 Grand Slam singles titles plus the Olympic gold medal. He and his partner have another distinction. They together hold more Grand Slam singles titles than any person has ever achieved in the history of tennis. A total of 30. I think that it's a safe statement that record is not going to be surpassed, certainly not in the near future. After retiring from professional tennis, Andre immersed himself in philanthropic activities, raising more than $85 million for his Andre Agassi Charitable Foundation. The Andre Agassi College Preparatory Academy in Las Vegas is an innovative K-12 public charter school that was recently recognized as a national model charter school by the United States Department of Education. The Academy's first graduating class this past June boasted a 100% graduation rate, which is phenomenal, as well as a 100% college acceptance rate, which is even more phenomenal. Andre has also joined with other athletes, including Lance Armstrong, Carl Ripken Jr., Muhammad Ali, as part of Athletes for Hope, and was the 1995 recipient of the ATP Arthur Ashe Humanitarian Award. Today's moderator is Barry McKay, another tennis legend, well-recognized tournament promoter and broadcaster, and a good friend of mine. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Andre Agassi and Barry McKay.
Can't Thanks. Take you anywhere, Barry. Look
Andre, great to have you back in the Bay Area.
Oh, it's good to be here. A lot of memories.
Indeed.
Thanks for coming out today, guys. Thanks.
You know, I thought I'd start off by going back to 1990. You were about a 17-year-old kid with long blonde hair and wearing those denim shorts. And a teeny bopper's delight, if you will. And as a promoter of the tournament, I said, bring that Agassi over, because all these kids that want to see him have to have two parents drive up, and they'll buy 2 more tickets. Anyway, those were good days, huh?
Minus the hair, yeah. The hair kind of made those days a little stressful, but good old days. No, it was all part of an incredible, incredible ride.
What was your feeling, Andre, walking out on the court there? The venue was pretty small, the Civic Auditorium, a little different than what you'd played on before. And any thoughts about that particular spot.
Which one are you referring to?
The Civic Auditorium in downtown.
Yeah, you know, I had such a blast playing here. I thought the intimacy of the crowd was just perfect for tennis. You know, it's big enough where you can get the energy, but also sort of close enough where you can get the connection. So it was a thrill to play here over the years, even though I got defaulted once.
I remember that one well. That was at the Sybase later in San Jose. I'll never forget that night. I'm in the little office watching on the monitor, and I saw this lines person go over and start talking to the umpire, and I said, that's a funny kind of thing, because it's not time to measure the net. And sure enough, you were on your way out.
No, that was a good. I was playing first round here in San Jose. I don't know how many were there, remember it or anything, but I'm playing, and I'm up 6-0 break in the second set, cruising, and all of a sudden this kid, Cecil Mammoth, starts to come back. We get into this tiebreaker in the second set, and I lose an important point, and I swear at myself as the crowd's cheering. Nobody heard me except this one linesman that was sitting like, and so the linesman gets up and walks across me. I'm about to return serve, walks to the umpire, tells the umpire that I just called myself a certain name, and the umpire gives me a warning. So this linesman has to walk back past me to sit down, and I'm just can't believe it. And as the linesman gets past me, I go, well, you're a blank. And the linesman about to sit down and makes a sweeping turn back to the umpire, whispers something to the umpire, and the umpire says, point penalty, Mr. Agassi, unsportsmanlike conduct, swear, abuse, obscenity. The linesman has to make this long walk past me again, and right when the linesman got in front of me, I went, you're still a blank, right? So, long sweeping turn, back to the umpire, tells the umpire just sits up in a chair, calls the supervisor out, supervisor calls me the court. Now, nobody in the crowd has any idea what's happening, you know, because when I'm saying this, I'm kind of putting my hand over my mouth, and the supervisor comes out and pulls us up to the chair and says, you know, Mr. Agassi, did you call the umpire so-and-so? And I went, well, I mean, do you want me to tell you the truth, or do you want me to, because I could lie if that's what you want me to do, and we can move on with the match. He says, I just need to know if he said. I said, yes, and that he still is a boom. So match over, default, and about 5,000 people were going, okay, what the heck just happened? They're throwing their seat cushions on the court, you know?
I remember it well. I had 3 heart attacks. Anyway, Andre, congratulations on the book. Big news. It's at the top of the best-selling chart on the New York Times. That's pretty nice.
Wow. I finally did something my wife hasn't done. Come on. I can't stand it. I bring home a trophy and she brings home 4, you know. It's like,
speaking of your wife, I saw her about 3 weeks ago. She looks like she could go over to Wimbledon and win it this year.
Oh,
she's in great
goodness.
Shape.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, I watched her play Kim Clijsters, who won the US Open. She played her in that celebration of the roof closing, and it looked like she was backing off her a little bit, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah,
yeah.
She's pretty good.
Andre, speaking of the book, I finished it up about midnight last night. Good reading, and I'm sure everybody has at least heard about it, or maybe a lot of these folks have read the book. But I was impressed by how much time you spent on the Mandela trip and that big trip to South Africa. Can you enlarge upon that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had a lot of more than a lot of people, a lot of epiphanies in my life where I got to a point where I just realized I needed to change, that it was time to come to terms with certain things. And, you know, one of which came in 1997 when I was coming off a pretty dark time in my life. And I was in a hotel room in Stuttgart, Germany, after I'd just taken a wild card ranked 141 in the world. I couldn't get into the tournament. They had to give me a wild card, which is a gift. It basically says, well, we believe that you should be in this tournament. And I went out there, and I shouldn't have been in the tournament. I got smoked first round and went to the hotel room. And my coach, Brad Gilbert, who lives in the Bay Area, who I love dearly, says to me, you know, listen, Andre, you need to quit or you need to start all over again. I think you have a game left. I think this is something you can really do, but you're going to decide tonight because, you know, we're not leaving this hotel room until we decide this. And he had no idea sort of where I'd been in my life and how depressed at times I had been and my hatred for tennis throughout most of my early years. And I said to him, you know, at that moment I felt like tennis was, I never hated it more than that moment, because it just, I never liked myself less than that moment. And I looked out over the Stuttgart traffic and I realized, you know, here are all these people that are going to jobs they probably hate, but they find reason to do it. And I've always talked about, I never chose tennis. It was never, it's a life I found myself in, a life I ended up in. What if for the first time in my life I could actually choose it? What if I could say, even though this life isn't the life that I want, even though I find myself here, what if for the first time I find reason to choose it myself, and I give new meanings to old tasks, and I start to change my attitude? Because you can always change your attitude. And what if changing my attitude and giving meaning can set two powerful forces in motion? And what if I can take ownership of my life? And that was one epiphany, and that was followed up with me coming back home committed to changing my life. And when I arrived back in the United States, I was walking through a airport in LaGuardia, and where I arrived, and I got a call from ATP doctor who said I just tested positive for this drug that I had used periodically in 1997 through my depression, called crystal meth. It's a horrifying drug. And when he told me I tested positive, I just watched my life flash before me. I didn't know what it meant, and I didn't know what I was in for, but I knew that I was really committed to changing my life, and here it is. Sometimes the momentum has its own sort of dictating. It dictates your life a lot of the time, and I was lost. I didn't know what it would mean. I thought I knew what meaningless was, and now here I find myself even lower. And I got a call to go down to Cape Town and go play an exhibition for Mandela's charity. And I went down there to do it, all the while not knowing what was going to happen to me in my life. But I listened to him speak, you know, and I watched his journey. I watched his plight. I watched him take Mount Everest and make it look like a molehill. I watched him talk about, you know, people's journey and how important it is that we make good decisions and that we make good decisions for ourselves. And I heard him talk about education and how, you know, apartheid and discrimination is all ignorance. It's not people need to be informed and educated. And it was just, I watched this man, and while my journey seemed, while I seemed like I was facing Everest, I know it wasn't anything near what he had faced in his life. But what he was sort of saying is, no journey is irrelevant, no journey is too small. And so I found this inspiration from him, watching what he managed to accomplish and get over in his life. Combine that with the education component, and I was just starting to think about I added education to my work with my foundation, but it was now starting to become my work, and it got me even more focused on my school, and it kind of gave me the strength I needed to overcome a pretty difficult time in my life, and I've never forgotten it. And you know, he's a hero to me, and he's changed millions of lives, and mine just being one of them.
I mean, you covered it in the book very thoroughly. In fact, more than a lot of the other issues that were in the book. I was impressed by that.
Yeah, well, you know, I tried to give the right attention to the most formative things in my life, and while certain parts that have been sensationalized that I cannot control, they fit at a certain part of my life. You know, part of 1997, I did go through these things, and I was committed to telling the truth about it, because it sure beats the alternative. And I do believe the power of my life lived is more so. If you thought it was from the outside, it's more so on the inside. And the ability to give that tool or those inspirations to somebody that I'll never meet just absolutely made any price tag that came with it worth it to me.
Andre, you back to some tennis. You talked briefly about your Davis Cup experiences. Can you tell me what went through your mind when you played that first Davis Cup match and they said game United States?
Yeah, no, that's pretty incredible. You know, tennis is a very lonely sport. I think the loneliest of any sport. You're out there on an island. You know, you truly are. You can't talk to anybody. You can't hide behind a helmet. You can't pass the ball. You can't play well for 30 minutes and then decide you're just going to slow down the game and run out the clock, you know, and you're always being measured against somebody. No, it's not that those sports are easy, mind you, but, you know, I talk about tennis being the loneliest. Even boxers have each other. They can you know, lean on. They can smell. They can feel. They sweat on each other. There's just something about knowing you're not here alone. Tennis, you're separated by a net, and you're 70. Well, you know this, Barry, 76 feet away from each other. And,
something like that.
In my case, maybe less because I was always standing on the baseline.
Right.
But
right. Hitting those half volleys off the baseline.
Yeah. You know, here's how you know tennis is a lonely sport, and I will answer your question, I promise. You know it because what do they say happens in prison when somebody gets sent into solitary confinement? Inevitably, solitary confinement leads to self-talk. I mean, it just leads to it. You're alone, and there's nowhere to turn. There's nothing to do. So you end up just talking to yourself. Tell me if you ever see an athlete who talks to themselves as much as a tennis player.
That's true.
But we don't stop there. We actually answer too. By the way, we really do. But back on the reservation. But Davis Cup was always an opportunity to feel not so alone out there, and you know you're part of a team, you're part of something that you're connected to but yet is greater than you are, and that was always immediate inspiration for me. I mean, a lack of inspiration in my life has led to some pretty dark places that I'm not horribly proud of, to say the least, but when I was inspired, it came with oxygen that I've needed in my life, and Davis Cup always had that. Just innately, just by the definition of Davis Cup, you feel that kind of inspiration, and it was very well embraced in my life, even through some of my rougher years.
Andre, I remember well when you were coming to our tournament, and we would have the annual press meeting there at the Waterfront restaurant in San Francisco, and you had just recently put your house on the market in Tiburon, and I know one of the first questions was, Andre, is your house still for sale in Tiburon? And you smiled and said, yeah, are you interested? I remember that very well.
Yeah.
What brought you to buying a place in the Bay Area originally?
Well, Brad Gilbert did. You know, he was my coach. He lived up here. And I always loved coming up here. It was something very calming to me about it. There's something I loved about the, you're interrupting. There was something I always loved about, you know, the moodiness of San Francisco, the class of it, the experience of it. I loved the fog coming in and moving out. I loved the smell of the air, the feel of, you know, the touch of the people. It's a different world up here, and it's a great place to practice. I mean, you know, a golfer would tell you, you know, you go play the Olympic Club over here, and you got to take a little extra club when you hit the ball. So you always had to work a little harder when you chose your shots up here in the Bay Area. So that got me interested. I spent a lot of time, and then it's one of the few places that made sense for me and my wife. I mean, I was in the process of trying to, you know, get her to think about moving to Las Vegas, so I can't just go Germany Vegas, right? I need...
So a little transition.
Yeah, so I talked about all the wonderful Germans that live in San Francisco, and I took her some parks that have a lot of trees, like she remembers, and then I told her we can't afford our house anymore, and sorry, baby, I've been doing a little gambling lately. Loved it here, but it just didn't. It wasn't our life. Our family now is in Las Vegas, and our foundation, and it's, you know, you can live in the most beautiful place in the world, but if you're not with the people you don't want to be with, then, you know, what the hell difference does it make?
Andre, the school obviously has been a big part of your life in the last 10 years, let's say. When did the first concept of starting the school over there sort of hit you?
I started my foundation in 1993, and I was it was designed to help children. I knew I cared about children like we all do, but I didn't know what the needs were and how to kind of focus my desires or what it is I wanted to do. And I did it a number of ways. I was with Child Haven, which is a shelter for abused, abandoned, neglected kids, and I was assistance lead. We clothe over a number of thousands of children a year. Boys and Girls Club, which was a beautiful national organization for after-school programs and hours. And I started to realize that, you know, geez, I mean, it's endless. It's like drops in an ocean. You know, you're always late to the party, always reacting to problems, you know. And You're sticking Band-Aids on real wounds. And that's what got me to think about education, you know. And I felt the lack of education in my life, the lack of formal education. You know, I was a person I always hated school, but I always loved learning, you know. So I surrounded myself with teachers, you know. I mean, others referred to it during my formative years as an entourage, you know. But it was teachers in my life. And I just felt like if we wanted to make systemic change, the only way to do that is to give those tools. So I focused on that. I started to look into education and realized that there's a lot of inherent limitations with our school systems, and saw this thing called a charter school, which is part state-funded and private-funded school. Allows you to kind of work outside the normal lines of a school, and you can have longer school days, 8 hours versus 6 hours. You don't have to have teacher tenure. So, you know, if a teacher's doing a great job with their class and their students, well, then great. But if they're not, then go on, do something else, because this is our most precious commodity. You can mandate parental involvement. The children have to behave by a certain code of conduct. You know, so there's a lot of things that I felt like, geez, if we could really provide resources, if we could give those resources accountability and offer that to the children that society are quickest to write off, what would actually happen? I actually treated it a bit like a laboratory. And Nevada's 50th in kids that we put into college, that we actually go to college in the United States. I know California is not doing great either, but Nevada's 50th in the United States. Mm. And this summer we had our first graduating class with the children that otherwise God knows where they would be. And out of our senior class, 100% were accepted into college.
Fantastic. Mm. Andre, you mentioned in a book, on a little lighter note, the day you won Wimbledon, 92, and looked forward to a dance at the ball with a young woman by the name of Stephanie Graf. And it didn't happen that night, according to the book. So how did that turn out, and have you made that up yet?
yeah, that was a buzzkill. You know, if you win Wimbledon, right, there's a hell of a chance you're going to be at the ball with Steffi Graf, because there's a good chance she won it on the other side. So I won Wimbledon once in my life, you know, and it was like, and sure enough, Steffi won it too, which that wasn't the surprising part. But they always had this traditional dance with the men, the women, and male champions, where you dance. And I'm not a dancer. I hate it. Matter of fact, I was just on the Ellen show recently, and I tell Ellen every time, I'm happy to do your show. I just, please don't dance. I mean, you can dance, but just leave me out of it, you know? But I was willing to put all that aside to have a few moments alone with Steffi. I admired her from a distance for a long time, and, you know, ultimately I have to wait about, 7 more years.
The early part of your book, Andre, deals a lot with your dad,
yeah.
Mike. I mean, I've gotten to know him through the years. How's your relationship now with Mike?
Yeah, it's a real good relationship. It's reconciled, and I've come to understand him a lot. Not terribly convinced he understands me, but you know, that's fair enough. You know, my father's a very interesting person, to say the least, and he was very clear to me. He's from the old countries, he calls it Iran. He was very clear to me to say, you know, don't expect me to read your book. I'm not reading your book. And okay, you don't have to read the book. He said, what the hell I need to read your book for? He says, you know, I was there. I know. I know what I did to make you a champion. You probably left out a lot of stuff, you know. And
not too much, I don't think.
I said, well, all right, fair enough, Dad. That's fine. But he, you know, he's a old school kind of person, and so much so that when I called him actually recently to see how he was doing, I said, you know, Dad, you're not going to read the book. I get it. That's fine. Don't read, but at least come listen to me talk about it. Or something, because you're hearing all this stuff that's been sensationalized, and you should have some context to put it in. I got to believe that it kind of shocks you a little bit about some of these things you're hearing. And he says, you know, it bothers me what they say about you. And I said, but what about you? Don't worry about me. I said, I know my life. I'm fine. I'll figure this out. I said, how about you? I mean, the things they say, I don't care what anybody says about me. He says, I'm 80 years old, for Christ's sake, what the hell you want from me? And I said, well, I just want to know you're okay with it. He says, okay, listen, whatever they say about me is fine. He goes, if I had to do this all over again, I would do the exact same thing, except I would not let you play tennis, baseball, or golf. Swear to you. And I said, why baseball or golf? He says, because you can play a lot longer and you can make more money.
I love it.
And I said, well, that's an interesting learning curve. But we go over to his house every weekend and I see him. We actually communicate with some affection now. I mean, hugging him no longer feels like hugging the pilot, which is good. You know, I remember the first time I hugged my dad, I walked off the plane. I said, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to hug him. I'm 17 years old and, you know, I'll just see what Pops thinks about it. And I hugged him. I mean, he stiffened up. It was like literally hugging the American Airlines pilot or something, you know. But we're now a bit more affectionate, and he's great with the grandkids, softer edges. But he's gone from telling me what I need to do as a tennis player to telling me what I need to do as a father, which has to do with, you know, disciplining my children more and making them, you know, my son should be hitting baseballs every day, all day. And then he takes this, I refer to this ball machine he built in the book. I call it the dragon. It's like this fire-breathing machine that just would just scare the living daylights out of me. So he's taken this new, you know, 2009 version of the dragon, you know, this, and that can it has like four wheels that spin viciously. So now all of a sudden when one spins a little quicker, the ball can shoot like this, like you're playing a righty, or the other way if you're playing a lefty, or this way if you're playing Steph and she's hitting that nasty slice, or this way if you're playing Nadal. And so my dad takes this machine and he has turned it into a pitching machine for my son.
I love it. That's great.
And so my son has to sit there and hit these tennis balls like they're baseballs. And you know, he doesn't take it so hard, my son. He's pretty relaxed about it. Doesn't take my dad all that seriously. And sometimes when the ball's around and my dad will walk away, he picks up a ball and throws it at him, you know. And so my dad responded the other day with, no joke, he looks and he goes, if you do that again, I'm going to kick you in the ass so hard you won't shit for a week.
And so
I kind of look like, is this, I feel like, and Jaden, my son, he kind of looks at me like, I'm thinking he's offended by my dad swore or something like that. He's looking at me and he's like, Dad, is it possible to not to not shit for a week? Is that like, he just wanted me to tell him, son, that's not true. Don't worry, you know.
That's funny. That's a great story. Andre, you won obviously a lot of big titles through the years. Any one match in particular that sort of jumps into your memory that was super important or that you remember very well?
Yeah, I remember most of them. Unfortunately, I don't have say over the contents of my memory, but the finals of the French Open in 1999, that was it for me, because on the court, you know, so many things jump to mind, moments that were important to the evolution of your game, of your psyche, but this was like 1999. It was 2 years removed of the darkest time in my life. I was nearly 2 years removed from being ranked 141 in the world, kind of being written off, as well as myself, writing myself off. I was about 40 days removed from a divorce in my life. I had a shoulder injury that I didn't think I was going to be able to play the tournament. I was 29 years old, and it was the last of the four Grand Slams that I hadn't won. I had won the other three, and I had never won there, and it was my worst surface. So it was like this tournament turned out to be like the microcosm of my life. It was like, and I found my way into the finals only to be scared to death because I could have won there 10 years earlier. And I'm like a deer in headlights. I can't move. I can't, you know, the ball looks like a BB. I mean, sometimes a ball looks like a watermelon. Other times it looks like a pinball or something, you know. And I was on that court and I couldn't move. I was just frozen stiff and I lose the first two sets. And, you know, that turning that match around, you know, was possibly, quite possibly, definitely changed my career, quite possibly changed my life.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you played in that particular match against?
Andre Medvedev.
Yeah.
I'm down two sets to love. And, you know, one of the things I love about my coach, Brad, at the time is there's just things he does that are incredibly annoying, but at the same time, very endearing. And one of his most endearing qualities is he never shuts up. I mean, just absolutely will. He doesn't need you to respond. He doesn't need any. He will talk from the second he wakes up to the second he goes. And sometimes it's useless information. And when he's talking about sports, though, you just listen because you're going to learn something. And so I'm in the locker room down two sets of love because we had a rain delay, and he comes in there, and it's deathly quiet. There's not a single person left in the tournament except me and my opponent, and we're sitting in this locker room, and he comes in, and I'm just staring off into space, and about 2 minutes goes by, and he hasn't said a word, you know? And I look up at him. I go, okay, you're going to pick this moment to finally shut up? I mean, I've lived with you for years, and I have asked you to shut up, and you refuse to, and now you're not going to say a word. And I'll never forget, you know, he slammed the locker door as hard as he could, and he just, you know, Brad never yells at anybody, and he just started yelling. It was like, what is it that you want me to say to you? You want me to tell you that this guy's better than you? You want me to tell you that you're doing anything out there that remotely resembles what you're capable of? He goes, well, I'm not going to do it. You're going to put this off on me. This is on you. If it's all so complicated, He goes, I got an idea. Why don't you just do what he does? Why don't you just see the ball, run to the ball, hit the ball? Right? Like, I mean, literally, he goes, you're not moving, you're not hitting. So start with the basics. See ball, run. Right? And he says, and if you're not sure where to hit it wherever he just hit it. So if he hits it cross court, just run, hit it back cross court. And he goes, you know, he goes, and I promise you, if you just let your shots go, this is going to be some. I mean, I deal with it much more intensely in the book as I talk about the intensity of this moment. But his message was so simplified, and you know, I walk out in the court, and now I'm just convinced I'm going to lose a different way, right? But my God, I settled into that match and turned that thing around, and you know, managed to accomplish something that to this day scares me how much it ended up meaning to me.
That's great. Andre, you and Brad were together, obviously, for about 8 years, pretty close. What's your relationship with him these days?
Oh, it's great. I had two messages from him this morning, you know, just because I guess he had no one to talk to. So so he thought, perfect, his answering machine, that's perfect. No, we spent a lot of time. We tried to get together last night. I was done really late, and we talk quite often. Talk about sports, talk about family, talk about all sorts of things, but we're very close.
You know, obviously, you didn't dwell on it very much in the book, and yet it's been a big topic, the crystal meth situation. I heard Martina Navratilova's comments, and you clarified those. Maybe, you know, I think it's fun maybe just to spend a couple minutes on your thoughts on that it's a recreational deal rather than something that's really going to help you play better tennis.
Well, I was pleased to know that Martina has no idea what that drug's all about, because that just... That just means she's never done it, so God bless her. You know, but doing crystal meth and playing tennis don't go together. I mean, they really don't. I mean, I even think that Martina would beat me if I was on crystal. I mean, it's impossible to. Your heart would explode. Physically, you'd have real problems. But beyond that, there's a huge difference between performance enhancer and a performance, you know, inhibitor. That's what that was. And I never played on it because you can't. But her reaction was one that I've always strived to not react in my life, because very rarely should you react versus respond. You typically you're not on the mark when you just react to something. And she reacted, but I understand the reaction, because it's taken me a life. Years to process my own disappointments, you know, with what I've been through. It's taken me years to process my own anger at myself, you know, and so to see somebody else's shock or anger or disappointment doesn't surprise me. you know, for somebody to process what I've been through in a headline is literally impossible. It's taken me 400 pages to somehow put it in context of a life lived. But the thing you hope for now moving forward is that one would take the time and the care to understand where it fits in the body of work, which in this case happens to be my life. And I know Martina well. I like Martina. I always have. And you know, her reaction will not change that. She has her own process to go through, and whatever she determines is fair to say or communicate. One of the things I respect about her is she will say it. So I wait with great anticipation.
She's not through talking. We know that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Andre, you mentioned Gil Reyes in the book quite a bit, a very old friend, yeah. The guy that has worked with you physically for so many years. What's he up to these days, and what are you doing with him?
Yeah, well, Gil is the Rock of Gibraltar. He is really one of the strongest people you ever met, you'll ever meet. He works with the Adidas program, developmental program, player development, which Adidas sends players through to, you know, players that don't have the knowledge of how to invest in their body, how to make themselves stronger. And Gil trains them when they come through Vegas, so he gets to kind of work out of his backyard and stay involved in training, which he's just so good at coaching because he's always so willing to learn, you know. And I get to go there every now and then and hit some balls with the guys and use it as an excuse to see Gil and spend some time with him. And occasionally I get under a bit of iron and try to make myself a little stronger. But he's just been such a teacher in my life, and I'll never lose appreciation for the place he plays.
Mm. Andre, some of us have been lucky to come to your terrific Grand Slam dinner in Las Vegas, and it's a great fundraiser. Can you talk a little bit about how much money it's raised and how that all started?
Yeah, well, you know, we had big dreams with the foundation, and we had to raise money to make any of this happen. I mean, I certainly gave a lot on my own, but I knew I couldn't sustain anything without creating that, you know, that togetherness with the community and afar. But I put together this Grand Slam for Children, it's called. It's just basically a musical extravaganza. We held it for many years at the MGM Grand Gardens. We've moved to the Wynn Hotel since, which is just a beautiful experience for the guest. And we sell insanely expensive tables to an evening of entertainment that I think is unmatched. I mean, we would have five incredible singers and two comedians just in one evening. I mean, we've had the likes of from Billy Joel, Elton John, Celine, Barbara, Stevie Wonder, Robin Williams, endless amounts of talent all in one evening. And we do hold a big auction item. And this year, to give you a little example, and in this day and age, which is not easy this year, but we just raised a few months ago in that one evening alone $8.1 million, which is pretty extraordinary. Yeah. Yeah.
And Andre, through the years, hasn't really that been the big fundraiser for the school?
I mean, we've had 13 years of it. I think we've raised somewhere close to $85 million just off that event, but that doesn't count a few tens of millions that we raised other ways that aren't quite so high profile. So it's been a full undertaking. You know, my goal is to fund my school in perpetuity because these kids, I'm charged with that duty. You know, Nevada funds at 48th in the United States per pupil allocation at about $6,000 per child, and my school funds at about $11,000 per child, which is $1,500 more than the national average. And this discrepancy is what I have to fund every year per child per year to keep the school going. Now, those costs are coming down a little bit because we're doing some creative things with solar and other forms of energy reserve. You know, but we got a beautiful program going. We have this wonderful lady. Her name is Chris Engelstad, and what she decided to do, what she's doing for us, is she said anybody that gives $2,500, I will match that up to every student you have in your school. So for $2,500, you could sponsor a student for an entire year of education, and she matches it. So, and as a result, throughout the year, our students will reach out to you and keep you updated on how you've changed their lives. So this sponsor a student campaign, which you could see on agassifoundation.org, is a real special program that allows people to have their dollars go straight to a child, straight to education, not to administration, none of that stuff, and be invested and connected with what we're doing.
Fantastic. Andre, you mentioned a guy by the name of Pete Sampras a few times in the book, and just maybe give us a few of your thoughts about Pete, not just the tennis world, but how you guys are different personally.
We're different. we're different. You know, the thing that has been surprising the most to me, not the most out of everything, because I've been surprised in other things, but is how little I know Pete. Hmm. You know, this book is written in present tense, and this book is designed to communicate how I felt in the moment of battle at the time of my process. I mean, I'm 18 years old playing Connors, and we have an intersection that happens that was quite formative in my life. I'm 25 years old playing Becker, and there's an intensity that happens that reflects and pulls you into my head. And so none of these are kind of judgments looking backwards, but there's some harsh truths that I have to sort of say, which is what it is I felt at the time. You know, I clearly celebrate Pete in the book as a champion he was. Not again.
Oh, wow.
That's all right. Yeah, all
Thank
right.
Thank you. Wow.
You know, but I'm also clear on how different we are. And, you know, one of the things that I say in the book about him is that there was just, you know, a lack of inspiration in my life has led to some pretty dark places. And I talk about at different times, my envy of his lack of inspiration and his lack of need for inspiration. It was quite an incredible thing that he did year after year. But it does highlight the difference, you know, kind of between us. But it's a read that you're going to understand it at the time it's said, you know, and at the time I'm living it. And that's the only way I could really organize my life into 400 pages. Nobody's life fits in 400 pages. But I turned this book into a stream of consciousness, and it's taken me 3 years and thousands of hours to do it. And my career, Joel, ends in 2006. So I read your review. So in case you're wondering why I didn't talk about anything after 2006, because the book has to end somewhere. I'm sure you realize that, right? But you had to say it anyhow. It says Andre was really open, but he didn't tell me what happened in 2009.
There you go. Andre, are you in touch with Pete every so often these days?
No, I ran into him for the first time in Macau, China, because we had to play each other. And, you know, he was giving me grief about the way I walk and all the times that he's beaten me. So I told him to stay tuned and read my book, and we'll call it even.
That's cool. How about right now in your life, Andre, ahead? Goals? Any new goals that you're thinking about?
Right now I'm very focused on sleep. I you know, it's important to calibrate your life, and I need to do that at this point. It's been a lot for me. I started this project right when I retired, and so it never felt like I stopped as it relates to reliving and understanding and pushing and trying to create something that has real power you know, in perpetuity, you know. And I feel like I've done it. I feel like I can take a deep breath now, and I feel like I can, you know, balance a few other things personally. It's come with a great deal of work. It's come with a great deal of pressure. You know, I've been scared to death about all of this, but nothing worthwhile in life comes without those things. So I've learned to finally commit fully despite the fear of failure, and I'm proud of what I've ended up with.
I heard you talking to Ron Owens this morning on the radio, and he started talking about retirement. And you said, "Well, if this is retirement, it's a hell of a lot of work."
Yeah, no question. I even got asked a question if I was just tired of being out of the spotlight, which is why I'm doing this. And it's like, I started this the day I left. I don't think that was my motivation.
Well, Andre, we've got some questions from the audience here. So I'm going to fire away.
And whoever, whatever one you read, you better take ownership of it. I want to see it.
That's good. That's good. Here it is.
Don't give me this anonymous stuff, you know.
Well,
we're all exposed today, all right?
We may have hit a couple of these. It says, what are your plans going forward to keep making education more visible as an issue that all Americans should participate in?
Yeah, no question about it. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan is doing a fantastic job trying to inspire and motivate each state to step up and have accountability with education. He's come to my school as recently as a couple months ago and was very proud of what he's seen. My hope is to get slightly more involved with the legislative side of education in our state, because we're the worst in a lot of stats. And if you can move that needle, if somehow you can affect legislative change that trickles into our whole public school system, and just move that needle a little bit, you can really have a platform for a national dialogue. It's a big project to take on education, certainly, and everybody needs to take the biggest bite they can, all the way down to the voter, who should have that as their top priority.
Here's an interesting one. Who would you like to play you in a movie adaptation of your life? Maybe you.
Danny DeVito.
Perfect. Here's one I think.
I saw him as a penguin. He was awesome.
I think this is from a tennis player, Andre. It says, how do you win matches, and how would you play against a guy by the name of Federer today?
I would choose to do what I'm doing, which is to sit on my couch and watch him. I clearly think Federer is the best of all time. I mean, the only other discussion could be Rocket Rod Laver, who, by the way, I'm sitting next to a legend myself. You know, Bear here, Barry beat Rocket Rod Laver in a live Davis Cup match in straight sets.
Cool. Yeah. Oh, man. Here's my new agent. Thank you, Andre.
He's done something that not too many people can say they've done. But Federer is just, I mean, listen, the guy's a freak of nature, really. And I wonder if one day we're going to find out he hates tennis or...
Here's one from a tennis player, Andre. Why do you think the serve and volley game has gone away?
I think it's gone away because of the strings, to be quite honest. I think the strings have provided players with the luxury of the harder you swing, the more control you actually have. So you can create more spin. And it used to be that, you know, guys back in the day could hit the ball hard. They just couldn't quite control it, so you had to choose how hard you hit it. But now with the spin, the bigger you swing, the more control you have. And the fact that you can get more spin, the court opens up to all sorts of angles. And so when you come to net, it's not about how fast you are. It's only about angles. So if you step inside that court and a guy gets to that ball and he can get that thing at your feet, or he can get that thing down the line, even though you have it covered, it's still over your head. I mean, you're pretty much a sitting duck up there. I mean, Barry, you'd be different because of your massive presence. You would just swarm them and take it over, you know. But that ball's, there's so many times where you go to cover a passing shot and you have to cover the distance laterally, but then you got to worry about the fact that the ball's up there and it's still going to land 6 feet inside the baseline.
Here's one about Iran. How do you identify with your Iranian heritage?
My father's Armenian, raised in Iran, in Tehran, and he never taught us the language. He was interested in the American dream, and I'm curious about it, but I got to say that never connected to it.
Okay, here's one, a little exercise. What kind of exercise did you keep in shape, and more than just play tennis? What were you doing in terms of off-the-court stuff?
Strength training. I think our sport is now starting to understand it. I think baseball figured it out. While you can question the means in which some of the baseball players have chosen to get stronger, the thing you cannot question is what their objective was. Their objective was to get stronger, because people will realize either slowly or quickly that the stronger you are, the more capable you are. I mean, period. And I think when I was off the court, I invested a lot into my strength training, which helped me with, I think, longevity, and then helped me adjust to the pace of the game. And it just made everything easier. It doesn't make you hit the ball harder, but it makes your average shot that much bigger. It's like a boxer. It's not like their haymaker is going to all of a sudden hurt more, but their jab is just going to somehow snap a little bit harder. And that's where strength can really help you in tennis, in fitness, in explosiveness. Our sport is not about running. It used to be guys used to go for 5-mile runs and just, you know, to get in shape. Our sport is about stopping and starting. And if it's about stopping or starting, then you better build the muscles required to accelerate and build the muscles required to break.
Here's one about the kids, Andre. Are your children going to attend your school?
My school is lottery only, and it's in the poorest neighborhood of Las Vegas, so it can't affect those children. So I don't have any say in what kids go there. If my kids got accepted, I wouldn't let them go, because that's meant for kids who can't, who don't have options.
Here's one. It says, how did you find the courage and aptitude to look inside and make such personal revelations in the book?
I wanted to understand myself first and foremost for me. I mean, you know, I've been asked this, and I've seen the curiosity in people when, well, geez, you've said so many lies about yourself, you know, over the years. What the hell? I mean, are we supposed to believe you now? You know, it's like, and the truth is my life, you know, wasn't a lie. My life was a constant pursuit for the truth. I never knew myself, you know. I give the analogy that, are you lying when you say to your first wife, I do, until death do us part? Is that really a lie if you get divorced, you know, years later? Or is it possible that at the time it is your truth, or at the time you don't even know what truth is? Or maybe you want it to be true so bad, or maybe you're willing to spend the rest of your life proving it to be true. But I've spent my life not knowing who I am. I didn't spend my life transforming. I spent my life forming. I think we all are in process. I don't think any of us can be treated as finished products or this is who we are, because it's continually changing. If I had written my book now, the book would look different than it did writing it 3 years ago. It's because we're constantly moving, we're constantly understanding, we're constantly growing. And I forgot your question.
I think I did too.
But I got to remember that question, because it was, do you remember it, Joel? You're not paying attention, do you? Huh? Okay.
Andre, here's one. If you hadn't chose tennis when you started out, what would you have done? Another sport, perhaps?
You're asking me to kind of unlearn something. You know, my whole point in not having choice in my life, it's not me saying woe is me. It's saying, you know, this is me. I didn't have the choice. But if I went back in time, and if I had an education, and if different things were nurtured, what would push my buttons? You know, you'd be asking me to unlearn in order to answer that, and that's the point of the whole thing, which is I'll never know, but it's okay.
Here's one from a parent. What advice would you give a 12-year-old kid who wants to be like you when he grows up?
I would first make sure it's not the parent who wants them to be like me. Who asked that question?
That's good.
Yeah, because that's a big difference. If it's the child really asking that question, which I call Yahtzee on, by the way, I would tell that child to aspire to be much more than me.
Here's one. Do you believe tennis stars are born or made?
Nature, nurture. Good debate, good question. You got to be born with something special. I mean, you're talking about being the best in the world at anything. You got to be born with something special, but it does need to get nurtured. I'm not sure it needs to be nurtured with a fire-breathing dragon, but it's but yeah, you need both.
Andre, I heard you talking with Ron today about one of your old rivals, Michael Chang, and his belief in God and all of his talks, if you will. Any thoughts about Michael at the moment?
You know, seems like a nice guy to me, but I talk clearly about, you know, Michael's obsession with crediting God for his victories. I mean, how dare God want me to lose, right? I mean, I would have respected that a little bit more if I saw him blame God, by the way. If I ever saw him go after he lost, okay, I just want to tell God, you know, but it just seemed a little too, odd.
Here's one. What has been the most surprising thing about fatherhood?
How little I know. I was really surprised, you know, realizing how much there is to learn in order to lead, you know. It's like giving somebody, you know, we're all charged with the duty as parents to give our children the roadmap to not need us anymore, you know. So we know where you want them to go. And then it occurs to you, how can I possibly get them to where I want them to go if I don't have the slightest idea on where they are? You know, it's like, it's really hard. So you spend all your time not thinking about where you want them to go, or because you know that. You spend all your time trying to understand where they actually are, and that's a moving deal. That's a, you know, it's a cliche, but it's a full-time job.
This one, we may have to identify the asker, Andre. It says, what will you do to celebrate your 40th birthday in February? I'm an Aquarius, too. Who is that?
Maybe she thinks I'm Pete. I'm in April, and I'm a Taurus.
There we go.
But it does mean we would maybe get along. I don't know. I've never been big on birthdays. They were never really celebrated with me growing up. I just... this wasn't a big deal. One year I want my phone to not ring on my birthday. I don't know. That would just mean something to me. Like, cool, everybody forgot. That's good. I don't know. It's never. But I try to celebrate it now because of the kids. You know, it's important to them. And I don't know. I don't think much of 40. At least not yet. But maybe that's what midlife crisis is. You don't realize you're in it.
It'll come and go. Andre, how old were you when you played your first tournament, and how did you do?
7 years old, and I won my first 7 tournaments I played. Yeah, which was me doing everything I was expected to do. And my first loss came... oh, I tell a good story about Jeff Tarango on the book.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, you know this Jeff Tarango... oh, this guy.
Tell that story.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
No, I'm about to. I'm just, you know. I'm playing my first match that I end up losing and get to a tiebreaker in the third set. And it used to be a 9-point tiebreaker back then. First one to 5 points, sudden death, with 4-all. So we get to 4-all in the tiebreaker. The person who wins this point wins the whole match, and we're having this long rally, and I eventually end up hitting just a beautiful backhand cross court for just a cold winner. Lands like middle of the court, like 3 feet from each line. Just couldn't have been better. I put my hands up. He starts crying and starts walking the net. And we get to the net about to shake hands, and he stops for a second. And he looks back and he goes, out. And then he puts his hands up, right? And then I start crying. Yeah, I know. You don't like him now either, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it was, you know, one of my strongest memories. And I swore I'd never lose them after that, wow. Juniors or pros. And every time I played them, I thank God there was a linesman on the umpire. But I held true to that.
Andre, I got to tell a quick story about the PR aspect of your life. You came up to our press thing there before our tournament, and it was when you were coming back from your wrist surgery.
Yeah.
And a lot of people wondered, you know, how are you going to do? Obviously, a lot of the press people, oh, he's not going to be able to come back. And you took the liberty to bring your doctor. I remember it so well. And the guy who had done the surgery, and you asked him to come up. And you sort of took over, and I just stood back and said, "It's Andre's show," and it was a great day. And he answered all the technical questions about your wrist. And you said, "Doctor, any more questions for the doctor?" And they said, "No." Andre said, "Thank you very much, doctor. You can step down." And I looked around and said, "Well, that's the end of the press conference. Thank you, Andre." That was a good day.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I still have the scar.
Was it tough coming back from that surgery?
It was pretty scary. You know, this is your livelihood. You know, and the wrist is crucial. And they didn't know what it was. They went inside. They cleaned it out. They didn't know how long it would last. The results of it. So I mean, if you have a slightest pain in your wrist, I mean, you might as well be playing with a pebble in your shoe or something. After a certain period of time, you just can't do it.
Here's one. What is the parent commitment of students at your academy?
They have to give volunteer hours, 20 volunteer hours a year. They have to sign off on every homework assignment for the kids. They have to read to their children 20 minutes a night, or if they can't read, their kids have to read to them, and we help mentor them to know how to engage with their kids. Yeah, they have to be able to nurture the very life that the kids are striving for all day at school.
Here's one. Kids again, what advice do you have for kids who play competitively? Can winning be fun? How do you deal with pushy or motivated parents that want to raise tennis champions?
You know, there's not a whole lot you can do when somebody starts their parenting with the decision that my kids are going to be great at something, you know. I think there's a lot of, it's just, you know, at some point, you're just not having the same conversation. It'd be like if we just disagree on a color. You know, you say it's one color, I say it's another color. There's nowhere to negotiate. There's nothing to say. It's just, that's who you are. You just end up praying for the child. But, you know, for a child in tennis, I think the most important thing is to make sure you're playing a game of the future, that you're not playing a game that helps you win now. You know, because it's easy to kind of be a slightly bigger kid and to run a little faster than somebody else and to push the ball back and let kids lose. And, you know, it's easy to kind of not really learn the game, but learn how to win. And that will come to a drastic end. You have to spend time on your fundamentals. You have to spend time on learning how to take calculated risks. You have to make sure that you're worried about playing great down the road, and that your game will translate as the game gets better. I think a lot of kids that are just interested, and I see it in Little League too. I see teams out there. I coach my son's Little League team, and I see coaches out there that are teaching these kids how to win the game. You know, they're telling them when there's a base hit and you're on first base, don't ever stop on second. Just run to third because there's a heck of a chance a kid's not going to quite make the throw in time. And you're going, okay, that's great. You know, you just advance the runners, but are they really learning baseball? You know, so that's what I would say.
Andre, here's one. Maybe they've been watching the Tennis Channel and my action too much. It says, have you ever considered becoming either a TV analyst or writing on tennis?
Writing? Like writing on tennis?
Oof. Like Mr. Drucker, perhaps.
Oh. Yeah. You know, I don't spell good enough to write on. No, I'm kidding. I love talking about the game, and I've never considered ever writing about the game. But being an analyst on TV requires a lot of time. It's not just as simple as showing up and doing it. You have to stay connected to the game. You have to understand the subtleties that change in the game. You have to know somebody's game. I mean, I could sit here and, I mean, Del Potro, for example, the guy that just won the U.S. Open. I would literally have to watch him maybe 6 or 8 times to possibly tell you what it is he's depending on exactly, what it is he's slightly uncomfortable with, what it is the opponent knows walking out there, what it is that's actually unveiling as a match goes on. I mean, it's it's homework. It's real time spent. It's time away from the family and that sort of deal. So I wouldn't, as you can tell, I don't take stuff lightly. If I get into it, I really get into it. That's reflected certainly in the last 3 years of my life with this book. But I love talking about the game. That's for sure.
Andre, thanks a million for coming. We sure enjoyed it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.